This is an Awakening Zone presentation, human empowerment radio and media for the 21st century and beyond.
Hi, this is Karen Elkins. I'm your host from Science to Sage Radio, and today we have a special guest, and his name is John Stuart Reed. He is an English acoustic physics researcher and who has studied the true nature of sound for over 30 years. Today we are talking about his recent article published in the April issue of Science to Sage magazine, and the article is called Science, Sound Gives Birth to Light. Welcome, John.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'd just like to say before we actually get into the talk proper that your magazine is absolutely wonderful. We love the graphics. We love the way that you are disseminating information all around the world. So congratulations to you.
Thank you. And I appreciate that you've been featured many times in the magazine because and even on the covers, the cymoscope images, the images of the sound vibrations that you're able to show are just absolutely stunning. So I so appreciate your innovative thinking, your out of the box. John is also the inventor of the cymoscope, which is, you want to explain that just a little bit, John, and then we'll get into the article.
Well, yeah, the cymoscope is an instrument that makes sound visible. So any sound that impinges on a membrane, so it doesn't matter whether it's the surface of your skin or the surface of a water membrane, which is what we're using in the cymoscope. Either way, when a sound actually meets a membrane, it must deliver a pattern. It must create a pattern on the surface of that membrane. And what the cymoscope does is it allows us to see the pattern. So when sound falls on your skin, for example, you obviously can't see the pattern, but under certain circumstances, with certain lighting techniques, you would actually be able to see that pattern. And what we do with the cymoscope is to use these special lighting techniques that allow us to see the imprint that sound makes on the surface of water. And as soon as you do that, it opens up a whole new world. It's a bit like it's when the microscope was invented, for example, or the telescope, it opened up new vistas, new realms became open to us. And it's the same with the cymoscope, in this case, of course, the realm of sound.
Well, let's go to the article, because that actually triggers many, many questions that I'd like to ask, but you know I can go off topic. So we'll go off topic near the end after we've done the article.
I'm sure we will.
So here's the question that I have for you. With this last issue, the question would be, how does light possibly give birth to sound?
Well, obviously it is a very technical subject, but I think we could begin by putting it into very, very simple terms. So, you know, when we rub our hands together, say it's a cold day and we're rubbing our hands together very vigorously, when we do that, we feel warm. But we're also hearing a sound at the same time, aren't we? We hear that rubbing sound, and what is actually happening is that the skin of one hand is rubbing against the skin of another. Now, if you take that right down to the atomic realm, what is actually happening is that atoms are literally rubbing past each other. They're causing friction. And around the atoms, every atom has a magnetic shell around it. So when you rub your two hands together, what you're really doing is you are rubbing atoms against atoms. And when that happens, of course, in this case, we create heat. Now, obviously, heat is an everyday phenomenon, and most people don't even think of it in light terms, but the reality is that heat is actually light. It's just low-frequency light. It's light in the infrared spectrum. So just getting back to this idea of rubbing your hands together, you hear a sound, yes, but at the same time, you feel warmth. And that is actually light. So that sound that you're creating by the frictional method, by rubbing your hands together, is actually creating light. So, you know, this fancy name for the article, Sound Gives Birth to Light, really comes down right to the nitty-gritty of rubbing your hands together and creating heat, which is actually light. But, of course, there's a lot more to it than that, and we'll go into a lot more depth later on.
But you mentioned something about the model of sound, and that you think in some way it's lacking. What do you mean by that?
Well, I've studied sound for basically all my working life, and worked with sound for like nearly 40 years. It all that time, as a sound engineer, as an acoustics engineer, I have known that sound is spherical, and so it's always kind of amused me to see in textbooks that acousticians or scientists, physicists are talking about sound waves, when the reality is that sound is actually a bubble. Now, of course, it's not that the scientists or the physicists that we're talking about here don't know that sound is a bubble. Of course they know sound is a bubble, and yet they still continue to talk about it as a wave. What they're really talking about, of course, is that this bubble that is created by sound is pulsating in and out. And so if you have to graph that pulsation, you graph it, the graph looks like a wave. So they've created this term, sound wave, to describe something that is certainly a graph, and when you graph it, it is a wave. But in reality, it's actually a bubble. It's a sphere of sound that's being created. All audible sounds create bubbles. So I've known this, like I said, you know, all of my career I've known this, but it struck me at some point that this simple fact was actually had caused some misunderstandings in physics. And if you were to go onto a street somewhere and stop someone, accost them and say, tell me what a sound wave looks like, I will guarantee you they will draw a wiggle. They will not draw a bubble. And so this basic fact, this basic piece of information is actually, in my view, is causing some problems in physics that we wouldn't have otherwise. And so that was one of the reasons that I really wanted to study the true nature of sound and to consider the holographic principles related to sound, all of which, of course, we can get into a little later in more depth.
Well, that reminded me, when you were talking, it reminded me, as like you said, you work with Rupert Sheldrake and the morphogenic field, and it's like turning in a channel, and we're never really, as Bruce Lipton say, we're never really dead or alive, we're just turning channels, we're either on or we're off at some point. But that goes back to, in the article, you were talking about the Egyptian creation myth, which also makes me think of Vishnu, because whenever they always have Vishnu dreaming, it's always in little thought bubbles. So why don't you explain a little bit about what you're talking about with that creation myth?
I certainly will explain my view of the creation myth, but just before I do that, just to mention Rupert Sheldrake, I have only just begun to work with Rupert Sheldrake, and so it's a little bit early days, but certainly I think we have some important work to do together. But just coming back to what you were mentioning there about the Egyptian creation myth, I think it's important to look at the ancient peoples and what they believed and where did this information come from. In this particular case, talking about creation, around about 700 BC, there was a pharaoh called Shabako. Now, Shabako had a stela, which is a stone plaque for all the world, created with some hieroglyphic text on it. And this text talked about the god Ptah and how he just brought the universe into being with his word. Now, obviously, I know that a lot of people listening will be thinking immediately about the Christian creation myth and so on. No one really knows where these creation myths began or even how they began. But in this case, it's a really interesting story because this Shabako stone, as it's become known, was later used as a millstone, which is very sad in some ways. You know, somebody obviously found this stone that had the hieroglyphic text on. This was probably long after hieroglyphs couldn't be read anymore, so no one probably even knew what the hieroglyphs said. But anyway, they used it as a millstone, and then around about the mid-19th century, the stone was rediscovered. Mm. With a hole right through the middle. And
it's a sound wave.
It became, a, Yeah, I mean, they obviously didn't care about the hieroglyphs on this stone, even though today, of course, it's probably the second most important stone that ever came out of Egypt. Anyway, so this stone eventually came into the possession, I think it was the second Earl Spencer, who was an ancestor of Princess Diana. And he, how he came by this stone, no one actually knows. It's all a bit of a mystery. But in the end, he gifted this stone to the British Museum. And of course, it was translated. The hieroglyphs were translated. And it turned out that this was a really, really important stone because it talked about the creation myth and how the god of Ptah had literally birthed the universe through his speech. And that same concept, of course, runs through so many different ancient cultures. It's not just the Christian, but also the Vedic, you know, out of India.
Yep.
Again, it's the same concept that sound created the universe and many others, the Greek logos and so on. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Where did this concept came from, that sound could create form?
You know what? I'm going to interject there.
I can't answer that question. But
no, but you know, John, the more I do the magazine and the more I'm always looking across different cultures and stuff, it seems apparent to me that there was probably at one point an original something of which all of these have morphed because, as we know, there's always 100 different commonalities between all of the religions. So I think there might be an original something. So I'm going
to... Well, that's really, it's an interesting thought. And, you know, I suppose if you talk to people who study the Vedic culture, you know, the various Indian cultures, they will say, well, our culture was the first.
Right.
But then if you study Egyptology, you find that the very, very early Egyptians, going right back to the Old Kingdom and even before the Old Kingdom, they were actually trading with India, right? The reason that they were trading with India was to get corundum, which to get the really hard stones, you know, the sapphires and so on, that they used in their various stone working techniques. And so I've always wondered, was it the Egyptians who gave this concept of sound bringing the universe into being, did they give it to the Indians, or was it the other way around? We probably never know.
Well,
but
you know,
an interesting thought.
I think the interesting thought is when you really look at it, the pyramid structures are everywhere in the world, submerged here, there, from India to Japan, and somehow I always chuckle that maybe somehow they had frequent flyer miles and they all kind of got around. And I know that's not some place you want to go. So
no.
Let's. So anyway, I have my thinking is it's all pretty much one and the same with different costumes on, and I think it's all beautiful and we've made it in a way that we can all comprehend it within each culture. So that's my thought. But you have had a special journey into the pyramids, and you did something where you ignited the passion of one of those, what do you call them, that you paid money to be into the chamber.
Oh,
that guy.
Well, the Egyptian antiquities.
That's
department.
It.
Yeah, what actually happened, and it really, this little story I'm about to relate kick-started the whole of my exploration into the world of cymatics, really, because what happened was very early in 1996, my father and I visited the Great Pyramid like, you know, millions of other tourists do and continue to do, and we went into the King's Chamber, and because, you know, I was an acoustics engineer, naturally I was really interested in the acoustics in that chamber. If it's quiet in there and they turn the fluorescent lights off, which, you know, they will do if you pay them some money, and it's really, really quiet, you could literally hear a pin drop, and you can hear your own breathing, and you can hear the blood coursing through your own ears. So it's an amazing acoustic in there. Well, again, like, you know, many, many thousands of people, probably millions, I don't know, I also wanted to lie in the sarcophagus.
Mm.
Now, the sarcophagus is a 3.7-ton piece of granite. It's red granite. It's been hollowed out. And supposedly, you know, it was installed into the chamber for Pharaoh Khufu. Whether that is true, we don't know. Nobody really knows, but certainly... there it is, the sarcophagus. It hasn't got a lid on. It's an open, empty granite box. And so, like millions, probably millions of other people, I lay in that box. What I was interested in, as an acoustics engineer, was what is the resonant frequency of this box? And so I did a smooth glissando. This is where you do a sort of a ooh,
your own,
you know, an unstepped enunciation of a sound, just a pure tone. And what happens whenever you do that in any reverberant chamber? I mean, you can do the same thing in your bathroom, actually, if it's a nice tiled bathroom. You could do the same thing. And what happens is, close your eyes and focus your all of your attention onto your hearing. When you do that, you will hear one particular sound that will seem much, much louder than any other. And this is because the sound bubble that you're creating, the vibration in that sound bubble happens to fit between the walls, say, of your bathroom, or in this case, in the sarcophagus when I was making this sound. So one particular sound sounded not only loud in this case with the sarcophagus, but it literally caused every cell in my body to tingle. It was a powerful tingling sensation that seemed to ripple up and down my body. Now, I didn't expect that to happen. I knew that there would be one sound that would be louder than any other, but I certainly didn't expect to be feeling it in my body the way that I was. And at that moment, I actually got the powerful thought came into my mind, I think this might not be accidental. This could be a contrived effect. So I leapt out of the sarcophagus with this thought in my mind, and a few months later went back to Egypt armed with a whole battery of equipment, acoustics testing equipment, to actually carry out a study in the King's Chamber.
John, hold on one second there, because before you go there, because we talked about that a little yesterday, and I want to ask a question. It seems as though to me that what we don't often think of when you're in the sarcophagus is that you're actually having an experience of a container where you can feel the vibration of your own thoughts and your own sounds reverberating to yourself. So you're actually bathing yourself in your own words.
Exactly.
And that in itself is your own frequency.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, in this particular case, there is a very good physics reason and acoustics reason why that particular sound is the prime, you could call it the prime frequency of the sarcophagus.
Okay.
It's not my sound or your sound. It literally belongs to the sarcophagus. And there's a very good reason for that, of course. The sarcophagus is resonant. You know, like I said,
does that mean it holds its own memory?
If you strike the sarcophagus with your fist, it will literally ring like a bell. So it has a resonance.
Okay.
And what I was doing with my voice was literally causing the sarcophagus to resonate. Now, any resonant object, any object that is resonant, let's say take a wine glass as an example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone knows the old thing, trick with the running your finger around the top. The wine glass will resonate at its natural frequency. This is called, in scientific terms, it's called its modal frequency, or it's one of its modal frequencies. And in this case, the prime resonant frequency of the sarcophagus, I later found, was 117 hertz. So that frequency belongs to the sarcophagus, not my frequency.
Right.
And by the way, it's not the only frequency that the sarcophagus resonates at. That is its most powerful. But there are plenty of other frequencies that it will resonate at. It's only that is the prime, you could call it. And when you reach the prime, if you're literally lying in the sarcophagus and you make this sound at 117 hertz, then you do feel it in every cell of your body. It's really quite astonishing, the sensation.
Well, is it made out of granite?
Yes, it's Aswan granite, which is a kind of pinky red color.
So it's sort of like it's a crystalline structure too, sort of, isn't it then?
It's very crystalline. It has Aswan granite varies between about 20% and 25% quartz crystal. So you could say you're almost lying in a crystal.
Yeah,
and it is highly resonant.
Well, Gene Webb, who's with me co-hosting today, we were talking the other day about that, and we were thinking it's almost like being in a crystal bowl where people actually go and have these crystal bowl experiences where these harmonics are in it. You're actually literally lying yourself in a kind of a beautiful crystal bowl and having it and enjoying its resonance as well, right?
I hadn't thought of it in that way, but I think you're absolutely right, Karen. It's like being in a crystal ball.
Yeah.
Dead right.
Yeah,
but
and
just
I...
getting back to how my whole experiment that I did in that pyramid ended up with the cymoscope instrument. You know,
mm-hmm.
this is the connection that we're trying to make here. And basically what happened was when I got back to the UK, you know, having had that amazing experience of feeling my whole body tingle and realizing, or thinking at least, that this was not accidental, that this was some kind of a designed-in effect, I naturally designed a whole series of tests that I wanted to perform in the King's Chamber. And a lot of the tests were very standard acoustics tests, such as the reverberation time of the chamber and so on. But one particular test is not a standard acoustics test. And this test concerned how to visually map the reverberations or the vibrations within the sarcophagus. And how I determined to do that, how I planned to do it, was to stretch a membrane across the top of the sarcophagus and then sprinkle sand on this torsioned or this tensioned membrane, excite the sarcophagus with a loudspeaker, and then observe, literally with my own eyes, the resonances that would occur in the sand patterns. And that is indeed exactly what I did. However, I first had to repair the sarcophagus, because those listeners who have been there and seen that 3.7-ton box will realize that the top is very uneven. It's broken away at its southeast corner. So first of all, I had to repair it, which I did with an expanded polystyrene blocks and a right angle of aluminum that I had taken specially for the job. Anyway, repaired the sarcophagus in a temporary fashion with gaffer tape and all sorts of other things. Then stretched this membrane across the top. This was a PVC membrane.
Mm-hmm.
It was torsioned by 43 little bags of sand, each one containing a measure of sand that we'd actually literally collected outside of the pyramid. And each bag had the same weight of sand in it, so that we had a fairly reasonably even tension across the whole membrane surface. Then I sprinkled sand on the membrane and then began creating sound in the sarcophagus, which had a little loudspeaker based in the bottom. And that loudspeaker was fed from an electronic oscillator. So what happened, of course, all I was expecting to happen was that we would be seeing a whole range of geometric patterns coming out on the surface of the sand. And what I had planned to do was to work mathematically with these patterns and see if I could find correlations between the patterns and the various frequencies that I was using. What I could never have anticipated happening is what did happen, which was that ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs started to appear in the sand. And at this particular point, I mean, I was astonished. I was absolutely amazed at what I was seeing with my own eyes. And at this particular point, the antiquities inspector, who was witness to the whole thing, rushed across and suddenly got very excited and animated and wanted to help me, where previously he was giving me a kind of bored expression, and I think he probably thought this Englishman is crazy, but he didn't care because, you know, the antiquities department had been paid a lot of money for me to do these experiments. But anyway, now he rushed across and he wanted to actively help. How can I help you with these experiments? And so he did help the whole way through, and each frequency that we created, each new frequency created either a new hieroglyph or a new pattern. It wasn't just hieroglyphs. There were some geometric patterns as well, but it was astonishing. And what, you know, without going into too much detail, because that really deserves, you know, a different talk, but without going into all that detail, let me just say that what immediately occurred to me after this series of amazing patterns revealed themselves was, this seems to me to have the makings of a new scientific tool, a new way to explore, in this case, the world of sound and vibration. And that was really the trigger. That was how I began thinking about what would a device look like? How would it be created that would allow sound to be made visible? And indeed, the very first cymoscope was using sand. It used sand as the revealing medium. Of course, we use water today, which is contains much more flexibility. The membrane is very highly flexible and therefore can show all the little nuances in any sound, regardless of the frequency or frequencies in the sound. But that was how it all began, Karen.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you're talking, there's a lot of pieces that sort of come together when I think of these pyramidal structures that are around the world, is that these structures are like a beehive, like a honeycomb shape, and maybe that the ancients knew that, like you're talking in the articles, if we make, by putting our hands together with friction, we create light, and then when we're with other people, our resonant fields create, then, as you said, the stars are singing to us. Maybe that they knew that there was this incredible exchange going on between the heavens
mm-hmm.
and us, and that there's a memory, and I think there's a whole big conversation. I think that we're going to go back to the article in the sense of what you wrote, but I think that's where the bridge is. But I also want to say it was the issue of the science of sound that we did, and that's just one of our very beginnings, where if you want to see some of the images that John did, that it's just an amazing one. There's a ton of amazing stuff in there. So anyway, so go ahead, sure. Because I think that's a bridge between how the stars are creating frequencies and what you've discovered. I think the Smithsonian Institute invited you to record the resonance of the planet. So why don't you go from there, John?
Let's go back to this whole idea of sound giving birth to light. Let's put a little bit more meat on the bone, and then we can talk about how starlight also is sending us sounds all of the time, bathing the whole of the earth in sounds, actually, but not sounds per se, but sounds in the form of modulated light. But anyway, yes, if we go back to right to the beginning, so we talked initially about rubbing our hands together, didn't
we? Right, yep, we did.
That creates heat. Now, if you were to rub your hands together fast enough, I guess that you would create light, but of course you would be very severely burned in the process. Let's get back to the nitty-gritty of atoms and how they react to each other, how they react with each other. So to begin with, you know, if we define sound in this way, we talk about sound in terms of the atomic realm.
Right.
What we're really talking about is how one atom is vibrating in more than one way at the same time. And when it collides with another atom, or another molecule for that matter, in its vicinity, how it passes the vibrations that it has onto its neighboring atom or molecule. So really, in terms of a basic definition of sound, it's simply atoms passing on their vibrations in a kind of daisy chain, or like the old game of dominoes where you've got them all standing up, and you push one, and that pushes the next, and that pushes the next, and so on. It's a daisy chain type effect. But when it comes to sound, there are really two things that happen when atoms or molecules collide with each other. The first, as we talked earlier about rubbing your hands together, is that every atom has a magnetic field around it. Now, that magnetic field, when it bumps against another atom, various things happen. You know how if you take two magnets and you move them so that you have, say, a north facing a north pole magnet, you've got one in one hand, one in the other, and you try to bring the two magnets together, what you will feel is a kind of sponginess, isn't it? You know, it's the atom, the magnetism, rather, in one hand or one magnet doesn't really want to connect with the other. It's trying to push it away. And that is exactly what's happening, or something very similar to that, is what is happening at the atomic scale. Each atom has a magnetic field around it, and when it bumps against a neighboring atom or a neighboring molecule that also has a magnetic field around it, you can imagine this kind of sponginess that's going on between the atoms. So the atoms are not literally moving through each other. They're in their own little space, and they're bouncing off each other.
Are they like dancing together?
Well, they are. It is a kind of dance. But But now let's, before we get into the light aspect of all of this, let's just talk again about the sound aspect.
Okay.
So if we take one atom, let's say it's an atom that's in your larynx. It's in the air, and it's very close to, well, very close to the little flap of skin in your larynx, that your vocal folds or your vocal cords, whichever you will. Now, when your vocal folds or your vocal cords start to vibrate due to the passage of air coming up out of your lungs, they create a sound, don't they? Now, that sound is literally a set of vibrations that this little atom that we're talking about happens to be picking up. It's now being bumped by the atoms in your vocal folds. It's now received those vibrations. Now, that atom that was, you know, having a nice day around your larynx there is now being given a new vibration. It had its own vibration to begin with, by the way, and that vibration was whatever the local temperature is in your throat.
Oh, I love that.
So,
okay.
That would be like, say, 98 degrees Fahrenheit roundabout, or it would be 37 degrees centigrade. That atom's already vibrating in space at 37 degrees or 98 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
But now you're giving it a new vibration. So now it's an atom that's doing two things at the same time. It's probably doing more than two, but let's just talk about these two. It's moving in space with whatever the temperature is. So in other words, like we were talking about 37 degrees or 98 Fahrenheit, it's moving backwards and forwards in space. Now you're giving it a new vibration. It's being given the vibration of whatever sound you made with your vocal folds.
So it's just, you're adding complexity is what you're saying.
You're adding complexity. You've now got an atom that's vibrating in two different ways. Now, when that atom bumps against its nearest neighbor in the air, because obviously there's lots of air in your throat, when that atom bumps against its neighbor, it must pass on that vibration, that new vibration it's been given. So it passes it on to its nearest neighbor, and that nearest neighbor passes on to its nearest neighbor, and so on. And so now you get a sound coming out of your mouth, and the sound will come out as a bubble. It will come out as a beautiful bubble, both from your mouth and from your nose, and it will merge together, and now we have this bubble of energy that is containing trillions and trillions of atoms and molecules of air particles, all vibrating with exactly the same vibration that your vocal folds gave it. Now, so that is a definition of sound. It's basically passing on of vibrations from one atom to another. But something else magical happens. Whenever you have sound created, you must have light created. Just like we were talking about with the simple idea of rubbing the palms of your hands together, you will create heat. Whenever you create friction, what's happening is atoms and molecules are rubbing against each other, and whenever that happens, there must be a release of light. Now, obviously, if it's low-energy collisions, such as we're talking about here with either rubbing your hands together, or if we're talking about making sound with your larynx, then these are low energy collisions, and they will create infrared light.
Okay.
In other words, they'll create heat. It's a form of heat, or a low energy state of heat. But what has not been known up to this point, or not generally known, let's say, is that the light that is created, the heat that's created by your larynx, is actually not steady state heat. It is creating modulations, and the modulations are literally the sound that you're creating. So now the heat that you're creating with your voice is literally modulating the light. Now, how do we know this is true? Right? And this is where this gets really interesting. How we know it's true is because the exact reverse of that is happening every time astroseismologists listen in to the sounds of stars. And what happens is, in this science, it's quite a new science called astroseismology, ever since the days of very sensitive infrared telescopes, scientists have been able to monitor the sounds from stars. And the way this works is like this. In a star, you have lots of atomic collisions occurring all the time, of course. The star is putting out heat. It's also putting out light. But also within the star, within most stars, there are sounds occurring. And these sounds are modulating the light of the star. In other words, the star, it has a little twinkle. Mm. And of course, when we look up in the night sky, we do see stars twinkling, don't you?
Yeah.
But in this case, the stars are not twinkling. In that case, they're not twinkling because of the sound. They're literally twinkling because of, you know, little differences in the atmosphere and the density of air in the atmosphere around the Earth. So that's not why they're twinkling. If you were to get outside the Earth, so you haven't got the atmosphere anymore, and you say you've got a satellite, a geosynchronous satellite there, and it's looking at stars, it wouldn't be seeing any twinkling stars, would it? But it would, actually. It would be seeing tiny variations in the starlight. These tiny variations are literally the sound that the star is making, but it's now modulating the light.
Here's a question I have. When you're talking like this, it makes me think that everything is on the spectrum. Everything is part of the electric light show that we're having. And it looks to me like it's morphing in and out with different resonance based on heat. So when I look at other cosmology stories as well, we're still talking about coming from the void. So depending on whether, you know, I think of like winter to spring, it's either I'm quiet and I'm dark and I'm in the dark, or I'm actually coming literally bouncing with spring with the heat to light. And so when we're looking at the stars or we're looking at bodies or we're looking at ants, it's all basically one and the same resonance of the electric light show. And we're all kind of sharing, we're all sharing our own song.
We are indeed. And you know, we can talk a little bit about that, if I just finish this point, first of all, about the starlight, and then
yeah.
we can come back to that. So starlight is modulated by the sounds of stars.
Mm.
And so the atomic collisions are occurring in the stars. They are causing the light from the star to be varied slightly, minutely, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And but nevertheless, very sensitive instrumentation in the infrared spectrum can pick up these modulations. And then what astroseismologists do is they, having received these tiny modulations, then convert them by demodulating those electromagnetic modulations. They demodulate them back to sound. In other words, they can now hear the sounds of stars. And what we've done is to take some of those star sounds. You mentioned the Smithsonian a little bit earlier there.
Right.
The Smithsonian in Washington asked us if we would make some stars visible using the Cymoscope instrument. And so they sent us a range of star sound files created by or received and processed by astroseismologists. We then put those files into the Cymoscope and literally imprinted the sounds of those stars onto the surface membrane of the water in the Cymoscope, and therefore made star sounds visible for the very first time, as far as I'm aware at any rate, in this particular way. Astroseismologists have already modeled the sounds of stars, but they're using computer techniques. What we are doing is very much a physical phenomenon. We are literally imprinting those sounds onto water. And so getting back to what I was saying earlier about how do I know that my voice is creating light? Well, there's the answer, because in reverse, stars are also creating light and heat, of course,
mm-hmm.
modulating that light and heat, and it's picked up on Earth. So what this means is that the reverse, although it's never really yet been proven, but I think one day it will be proven, that our words, our songs, when we at least speaking or singing outdoors, those words and songs that we create or that we sing will literally be modulating the light that we are creating with our voices. The heat will be modulated by those sounds. And one thing that's very obvious about the atmosphere of Earth is it's fairly transparent to heat.
Mm.
You know, so heat will heat, of course, is you know, part of the light spectrum. And heat travels very, very easily through the Earth's atmosphere. So theoretically at any rate, or hypothetically we should really say, I suppose, at this stage, your songs will travel out into space. And we actually have an experiment planned that will hopefully prove just that.
Well,
so that's something that we will talk about another time.
There's one thing you have in the article, which I think is really, it's a cool image too, is where you show all the, what is it, 1,000 monks singing their prayers. Explain that, because I thought that was beautiful.
Well, it is. You know, we're talking here hypothetically about sound in the case of vocal sound. Our vocal sounds going out into space and one day reaching the stars. It's a very poetic thought, but it's almost certainly true. And we, like I said, we hope to be able to prove that one day. But one of the things that is pretty obvious is that the amount of heat that your vocal folds create is tiny. I mean, it's a really, really small amount of heat. But when Buddhist monks pray and send out their prayer to the universe, they vocalize their prayer. They always do it in a vocal way, and they also have a huge bell in their temples very often, and they sound the bell. And their concept is that the sound of the bell will help to carry their prayers out into the cosmos. And now, because of this whole concept of sound giving birth to light, and that sound is modulating light, or at least in the infrared spectrum, it seems to me that when you get 10,000 monks all making the same vocal sounds, that what they're really doing is they're effectively amplifying the tiny amount of heat that would be created by one vocalist, one monk, and magnifying it or amplifying it 10,000 times. So you've got the very real chance that, that their prayer will one day reach the stars. It's quite an incredible thought that how could the monks have really known this without any scientific grounding? But now that science is kind of catching up with these ancient ideas, it looks as though it has a foundation in reality.
Well, you know, when I think of that, it's the Global Coherence Initiative that they send out every, especially when there's a full moon, they send out, you know, everybody pray because the Earth is actually... people are going a little more loony is what we'll say. So part of what you're saying, too, is that there is an exchange between the stars. They're resonating for us. And actually, it almost makes me think, it does make me think, it's like of astrology, is that each one of us is affected as we circulate through the galaxy with other interference patterns, which would be other sound frequencies, which is the essence of what I think of astrology is meaning to say. And so what you're saying, when I've seen the pictures of the different planets, each one is definitely singing their own song. And NASA, if you actually go to NASA's website, you can actually find the resonance of the planets. Some of them, I think is it Jupiter that sounds like a Gregorian chant. And so I think that goes back to the search of extraterrestrial intelligence. We are sending signals out to the stars in the form of infrared light, and that is modulated by the sounds we make on Earth, shouldn't sounds in our planets be coming our way? And I mean, it's not even that they're coming our way, that we're all bathing in each other's frequencies.
Indeed we are, and this is a really, really interesting thought, because it's only probably 2 years ago, I think it is now, that I first came across this knowledge of the James Webb Space Telescope. I first heard about the James Webb Space Telescope, which of course is the telescope that is mooted to be replacing Hubble, and that is due for launch, I think, at some time in 2018. But when I first read the story, the NASA story about the James Webb Space Telescope, what really interested me was its primary function, which is not to be looking at the stars in terms of the visible light spectrum, although it will have some capability in that area. But its primary role will be looking at starlight and indeed galactic light and so on in the infrared spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we've just been talking there about how stars sound, how stars send their sounds to us, and how we are, at least hypothetically, sending sounds to them in the form of modulated infrared light.
Right.
Well, it occurs to me that, you know, this whole business of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, where you know, the SETI organization are listening in to sounds from space in terms of modulations of radio frequencies, and hoping that one day they'll pick up a radio frequency signal from some intelligent life that's actually sending it out into space. Maybe they're not sending it directly toward us. They wouldn't know about us, obviously, but they're sending it out into space nevertheless, in the same way that we are, with television transmissions, radio transmissions. All of those things are rushing out into space now and have been for many years, of course.
But that's all registering of light.
But yes, this is the whole thing. I'm thinking that maybe instead of listening in with, you know, huge radio telescopes to the stars, that one thing that we could be doing is to listen in with an infrared telescope.
Mm.
And what we would be interested in would be seeing if any of the sounds coming from these various star systems are modulated in an intelligent way. So, you know, the fact that the James Webb Space Telescope has been designed specifically to look at the infrared spectrum with great sensitivity, far greater than any other instrument ever created on Earth, that we will be able to monitor the heavens in the infrared spectrum with enormous sensitivity. And it just seems to me that if there's an ocean on some distant planet, we might be able to hear the sound of that ocean as it's making its sound on that distant planet. Or if someone is, this is probably a little bit far-fetched, but maybe if someone is singing on a mountaintop on that distant planet, we'd be able to hear them singing. You know, that is a little bit fanciful, but...
You want to hear something fanciful?
I was listening
to Rupert Childrick. I had the pleasure of seeing him at the Electric Universe Conference, and he was up there speaking, and he said, maybe the sun, listening to what we're creating down here on the planet, it gets really mad, and it sends us those mass ejections, and it says, take that back down.
Yes.
I just thought, you know, Rupert, you're right. Maybe so. And then there was the other thing Walt Thornhill who said. He said, maybe it's all resonance. So if something dissipates from this planet, that it'll resonate someplace else. So that maybe there's dinosaurs someplace else. And maybe we're in this truly a morphogenic field of light, where it's truly an electric light show. We live in an electric universe. The more you look, it just becomes incredibly obvious, and it is all sound. And so go ahead.
The other interesting aspect to that, you know, we were talking earlier about resonance, and another really interesting aspect to this, which again leads us to talk about infrared light rather than the visible light spectrum, is that it's now well known that all of the cells in our body are communicating in the infrared spectrum.
Mm.
So they're literally sending electromagnetic signals, but in the infrared spectrum, to each other. They're communicating with each other in infrared. And when a person is just at rest, they're, of course, radiating heat. You know, you'll be radiating heat now. Your temperature will be roughly 98 degrees or 37 degrees centigrade. You're radiating heat all of the time. But what is probably not commonly known is that heat that you're radiating is modulated by the signals in your cells. So all of the chatter that's going on between your cells, where they're sending and receiving signals between each other, that is actually modulating the heat of your body. So you are sending out not just steady-state heat, but heat that's modulated by this cell chatter. And if you think about it, you know, if you are very physically close to someone, and I don't mean necessarily that you're in love with them or anything, I'm literally talking about somebody sitting next to you on the sofa.
Right.
Right. You can feel the heat of their bodies, can't you? Of their body, rather.
Well, you get their vibe.
But what you're also feeling, exactly, you're feeling their vibration.
Yep.
And that, I think, although many people might not be able to sense it consciously, that at some level your body is literally picking up on the signals from the other person sitting next to you, because we've just been talking. Cells communicate in the infrared spectrum. So, and one of the things about infrared, of course, if you've ever sat next to an infrared lamp, you will know that infrared penetrates very deeply into soft tissues. In fact, they use it as therapy, don't they? It's a therapeutic modality, you know, to have a heat lamp, and it penetrates very deeply. And so this heat that you're feeling from your partner, your friend, whoever it is that's sitting next to you, is actually penetrating deeply into your body, and it is bringing the signals, the chatter from those cells into your body. And so perhaps, you know, when people talk about the resonance and the vibration that people feel when they like someone or they don't like someone, perhaps that's really what we're talking about here. It's the resonance that's occurring between cells of your body and their body, but in the infrared spectrum. It's an interesting, very interesting thought.
I have one question, and then Gene wants to ask a question. I think that reminds me of people say, well, do you have chemistry? And when I think of chemistry, it's the particles dancing, these little atoms dancing, and either those little arrangements are finding literally a bond and a likeness that they want to go to. And I think, you know, when you think of water, it does exactly the same thing. It clusters in exactly the same way as we as people do, and planets the same. I think we often want so often to separate all the disciplines, but they're not. They're not.
That's
I like that
true.
What you call it. And the other thing I think when you and I were talking yesterday, that was a hoot. When we talk about these things in a scientific term, they're called excitation. But actually, to me, it's that when we get to be around people that we like, we get excited.
Yes, indeed.
And it's as simple as that. I think that's it sometimes just to make the science simple. So with that, Gene, go ahead. You have a question.
Yes, just as a complimentary part to what you're saying and what you're doing here and relating to the infrared wavelengths here.
Yes, sure.
You know, we're talking about heat and talking about warmth, and just to, you know, make an addition to what's going on with that as well, most of the signals, at least here in the United States, that are sent to our television, the little remote control is an infrared remote, and because this infrared can actually carry the information of the electrical code that we're giving it and transmit it through the air to our television and turn it on or off or change channels.
That's a really interesting thought. I certainly hadn't thought of that one before. But one of the things you have to remember is that infrared is actually a very broad spectrum of frequencies. It's not a narrow spectrum at all. It's far broader than for example, the visible light part of the spectrum. And so,
well, it runs from approximately 0.07 microns to, you know, 1 millimeter. So, you know, I mean, we're talking that much of a spectrum,
right?
No,
the figure's better than I do. But the point I'm making is that the infrared remote controls are operating in a very specific and narrow bandwidth. And also, the other thing to remember is that they're being programmed in a digital way. They're not being programmed in an analog way. So all of your cells are communicating in a particular range of infrared, but they're also communicating with analog signals. That is to say that the amplitude of that infrared is being modulated by their signals. Whereas with a handheld remote that you're using to control your TV, it's very much in the digital domain. So it's a series of on-offs, in other words, happening at a very fast rate, of course, but it's nevertheless digital. And so, in other words, your body, even though it may receive some of that infrared energy, is not going to recognize it. It's going to completely ignore it because your body doesn't understand the digital domain. It understands analog.
Exactly, and I've just got one more follow-up here just to relate to the same kind of thing. We're using fiber optics and so forth, and I understand that's pretty much worldwide now. And, of course, the light can actually carry a lot of this other information as well, and much of it's being done digitally.
I think, are you thinking more of, like, how do different color plants carry a code, and how does each individual aspect of life carry a code
and then
unfold within that resonant field?
It can go to there, just as you
say,
with each of the plants, absolutely, because once we get into this concept of the information being carried by each of these forms of light, whether it be infrared or whether it be, you know, visible light or whether it be some other aspect of a cosmic ray, that's coming from the universe. I mean, this may be broadened and expanded and relate to what you're doing. Part of what I was wanted to ask here was this concept of the standing wave. Anytime you have a sound or you have any other kind of a radio wave, we can create a standing wave in which there is no vibration. I was just wondering if you could address that for just a moment. Where there is no vibration there, how do we equate that into this?
Are you talking about standing waves in electromagnetism or standing
yes.
waves
uh-huh.
in sound?
Both.
Well, it's a huge subject. That is a very, very big
I know.
Subject.
I know.
Okay, you guys, we have 5 minutes, so you have 5 minutes
okay.
to answer this very big
minutes.
Question.
Well, very quickly, let's talk about the cymatic model, because you know that's been a main focus for us in this particular talk. In cymatics, you know, it gets back to the cymoscope and what we're doing here in terms of imprinting sound on a water membrane. What happens is the ideal shape for the membrane we've discovered is circular, which is no surprise, with sound being spherical. So what we're really doing is kind of taking a slice through the sonic bubble and allowing us to see a slice through the bubble. But what happens is when the sound enters the water, it enters in the central area of the water and then creates little tiny ripples on the surface of the water that move outward to the boundary. Now, when they reach the boundary, these little ripples, and we are literally now talking about waves because this is sound impinging on matter, real matter, in this case water.
Right, and then it bounces
little,
back.
Tiny, little tiny ripples. When the sound bounces back from that circular boundary, the wavelets that are coming back towards the ones that are going out will now kind of merge with each other and create exactly what you're talking about, which is a standing wave. Now, that pattern of energy that's created at that moment when the outward wavelets and the reflected wavelets merge together, that pattern is in every sense a model or an analog of the sound itself. So, in other words, when you see a cymatic pattern, it is literally a model of the sound.
In order to
get back to the original sound from a given pattern, in other words, to analyze a pattern and say, well, okay, what sound or sounds created that pattern, you need to have a mathematical model of the pattern itself, of the geometry that can take you back to whatever the original sound was. And that is something which currently no physicist, no scientist in the world can do, but it is something that we are actually beginning to work on with one of the world's top mathematicians. And so there will come a day when these standing waves that you're talking about, Gene, will actually be understood at a level where we can say that pattern was created, once you know all the parameters, of course. You have to know the size of the, you have to know the diameter
Certainly.
Of the water, you have to know the air pressure, the temperature. There's a whole range of parameters that you need to understand and control, indeed. Once you understand all those and you can control them, you can then mathematically model the whole thing and be able to say that this pattern was created by this sound or this range of sounds and so on, and work it both ways. When that day comes, the science of cymatics will truly be a science that will be able to take us into the future, because it's such a powerful tool. It's a visual tool, and you know, the visual acuity of our brains is such that when we can see something, we can understand it at a far deeper level than we can with our other senses. So this is why I'm so excited about cymatics. It's because it's a very powerful visual tool. Needs to have the mathematics developed, and of course we have started down that road. And so it might take many, many years for the mathematical model to be developed, but one thing is absolutely certain, that it will happen. And I believe it will happen well within our lifetimes.
I'm going to add one comment here, and I think there's a caller who wants to add a question, which I haven't done before, but we'll do that too. But here's, I think, a note of what you're saying. When you did the research with the dolphins and you cut the bubble in half, you could see that they were probably communicating with visual sound shapes. They were, you know, kind of almost like the hieroglyphs of the past.
Yeah, dolphins, it's been now proven absolutely that dolphins are communicating. They have a form of language. Their language is a pictorial language, which no one had figured before we did the work with dolphins. But we've worked with Jack Kasowitz, who is a Floridian researcher, based in Miami, and he's worked with dolphins for many, many years. And what Jack did that was so unique in the world of dolphin research, he set up in a dolphinarium, a dolphin pool, a series of objects. There was a plastic duck, there was a plastic cross and a ball and a flower pot and various other objects. He set them up in the water and he allowed the dolphin to see these objects with its sound sense. You know, it has this echolocation sense where it can actually see objects at a distance in water. And I guess that nature, evolution has allowed this to happen so that the dolphin can see in murky waters. I'm guessing that's the reason why it developed this technique of biosonar is one way of talking about it. Anyway, so he set up these objects in the water. The dolphin naturally looked at the objects with its sight, but it also sent out a sound beam, which is this echolocation beam. The beam then reflected off the object. That reflected beam was then picked up by Jack with his very, very sensitive microphone. It's a hydrophone.
I think your phone's kind of bugging out on you, isn't it?
Okay, the sound was picked up by the hydrophone. Then Jack Kasowitz sent us the sound files one by one over email, and we put the sound files one by one into the cymoscope, and guess what happened? We were actually able to see the same objects that dolphin saw just by using the sound file, literally imaging the sound file in the cymoscope. So if the dolphin looked at a flower pot, what did we see on the surface of the water? A flower pot.
Mm.
Now, what this proved was that the dolphins are using a visual language, because what Jack then did was he jumped in his car, went to a different dolphinarium, and played the same sounds to a completely different dolphin, and that new dolphin was able to find the same objects in its pool with an 86% accuracy, which was an absolute proof that dolphin was able to see with sound. So in other words, when the sound that Jack played to the dolphin was just a sound that you or I would hear as a sound, the
right.
dolphin saw that sound as a picture. And therefore, we now know through this cymoscope research that dolphins actually communicate in this visual way. But that, again, is a very big subject area.
Yeah, and that when we did, I think, I forget what issue we did that in. But hold on, we have a caller in here. One second, we'll take this one caller, and I think you're close to the time you wanted to be at. So hold on one second.
Fine.
Here we go. Hello?
Hello?
What can I...
Hi, John.
What?
Hey, Karen,
Hi.
Thank you for bringing this to the world, I guess. I'll try to make it short. John, you spoke earlier in the show about hieroglyphs forming in the sand.
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah, and what's your question?
Oh, and I was wondering the nature... Hello?
Yep, we're listening. Just continue.
Okay.
Continue.
The nature of the pictures. I go into the desert up here in the rocks, and I've seen pictures in the sand up here, and I'd like to know the nature of the pictures that you said were
thank
in the hieroglyphs.
Well, thank you for your question. Very interesting question. The hieroglyphs that appeared on the membrane, PVC membrane in the King's Chamber that day, there were a number of them, about 20 in total, but some of the ones that are commonly known is the hieroglyph for Ra, the sun god, which is a circle within a circle. So it's two circles, you know, concentric circles. That was one of the hieroglyphs. There was another one which was which was absolutely fabulous to see because it was so dynamic. And it was the Osiris, the symbol for Osiris, the backbone of Osiris. And it's like a kind of, how can I explain it? It's like, it looked like a snake that was writhing on the surface of the membrane. But another way to describe it is, because it's a backbone, it is a series of individual nodes down the length of the hieroglyph, the individual little components. Any listeners that want to see these actual hieroglyphs that we photographed that day, there's a booklet called Egyptian Sonics, and it's available on our website, and it's just a few dollars, and you would be able to see all these hieroglyphs. There's another one called the Saar Loop, which is like a kind of knotted piece of rope, and that is a symbol for protection.
Mm.
There was the Wedged Sacred Eye of Horus, and a whole stack of others. I mean, many of them are shown in the Egyptian Sonics booklet, but of course, I think a lot of listeners will probably be thinking, well, how on earth could this be? How could you have hieroglyphs, you know, in the sand coming out of an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus? Is it the case that the Egyptians somehow had a high-tech science where they could embed these hieroglyphs into the stone that now become visible all these thousands of years later? Well, my hypothesis to explain this is actually very simple, and it is the fact that when you work granite, when you in this case, don't forget, it's a big box of granite that had to be hollowed out with tools. Whenever you work granite, you get this kind of beautiful ringing sound. It rings just like a bell, as I mentioned earlier. And again, you know, just referring to what we were just talking about there with dolphins, that sounds can have, well, all sounds actually have structure in them. And so when the granite that was being worked by tools was giving off these wonderful sound fields, these rich ringing sounds, the guys who were working the stone were literally receiving those sound pictures. Now, okay, the masons may not have done anything with that, but what about the scribes who were standing in the near field? They were picking up these sounds, and the scribes, whether consciously or perhaps subliminally, would be picking up these amazing patterns that were occurring, that were literally coming out of the granite. And there's one fact that I'll close with here, which is this, that the date when granite was first worked in ancient Egypt, a place called Nekhen or Hierakonpolis, just south of Luxor, that the date when granite was first worked was around about 3,900 BC. Now, it may be no coincidence that the same date, 3,900 BC, is when the Egyptians were first developing their hieroglyphic language, in the same place, the same location, and the same date. Now, if I don't believe that's a coincidence, and I think that what happened was that the working of granite literally influenced the scribes to create certain hieroglyphic forms, and that is why thousands of years later we go in the pyramid, sprinkle sand on the sarcophagus, and see hieroglyphs coming out.
I'm going to give you my 2 cents. Can I give you my 2 cents on that?
Sure.
It's not yours. You know, we're crystallized light into form. Crystallized people, bodies of energies, all have a resonance. The pyramids that they were working with crystals basically hold the memory. Everything, any crystallized structure holds memory. And so to me, there is a solid memory sitting in those rocks that is resonating out, because it too, it's it's a mass amount of energy. I think when Freddie Silva says in his books, why did the monks go to the mountains? It's because it's one big mass of energy of granite, you know, rock form, crystalline structures, which holds an immense amount of energy. And I think that
there's certainly truth in what you say, Karen. You know, any crystal will hold an electrostatic charge. So,
yeah.
You know, there's the piezoelectric effect that you have with crystals, where you make a sound, and that sound minutely deforms the crystal, and that crystal now has a charge, an electric charge. And you can reverse the process And if you strike the crystal or excite the crystal with sound, it will give off its electrostatic charge.
Yeah, and
so
there you go. Isn't that beautiful?
It is, but the thing that's very important here to remember is that although crystals have this ability to store energy and to store electric charge, that we're looking here for a mechanism which is powerful enough to cause a membrane sprinkled with sand to vibrate powerfully enough to form a hieroglyph in the sand. Now, therefore, from a scientific viewpoint, what I was looking for was an explanation that would involve enough energy for that to happen. And I don't believe, although I know there's truth in what we're talking about here about electrostatic charge patterns in crystals, but I don't believe there's enough energy present to cause those hieroglyphs to form. I really believe it's an acoustic effect, which is the one that I mentioned.
Well, I still think it's acoustical effect because it's all sort of still resonating now. That was just my thought. But
anyway, very interesting question to the caller. Thank you for that.
And so, you know what I want to say to everybody, definitely visit, it's thymoscope.com, is it not, John?
It is, thymoscope.com.
And
do visit, and I'm sure you'll have fun.
But I just want to let them know that not only from the conversation we've had, that you've crossed all the different disciplines in the sciences, which I think are key, and you can actually see how your chakras resonate. You know, you can buy certain things on there that you can play and do things on your own and discover and play. It's a beautiful thing. And so, John, thank you so much for joining us today. And with
it's
that,
it's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, it's really been fun. So thank you. I think it'll go on forever. I think, you know, I might have to call you back. So anyway, yeah.
I hope all your listeners have enjoyed it and have learned something, and I certainly have had fun.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an Awakening Zone presentation, Human Empowerment Radio and Media for the 21st Century and Beyond.